From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Steve Earle on writing songs and writing fiction. He's just published his first book, a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. Several of the stories are based on Earle's own experiences, like his recovery from heroin addiction while doing time in prison, and his later experience witnessing the execution of a death row inmate he had corresponded with over the course of several years. Also, rock historian Ed Ward talks about the music and lives of three blind bluesmen of the 1920s, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Bel Canto. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon met with President Bush at the White House today in advance of Secretary of State Powell's departure for the Mideast. Sharon insisted on 10 days of complete freedom from violence between Israel and the Palestinians before he would move forward to a cooling-off period in advance of peace talks. He told reporters a cooling-off period itself should last 6 weeks or more, followed by what he called confidence-building measures and then negotiations. The South Korean government says it's willing to provide political asylum to seven North Koreans holed up at the United Nations Refugee Agency in Beijing. Michael Wengert reports from Seoul.
A foreign ministry spokesman here in Seoul says South Korea is not in a position to intervene because the matter is totally up to the Chinese government. But he said Seoul is willing to accept the family if they're given refugee status and want to come here. The UNHCR has said the family deserved asylum and that it was trying to work out the matter with Chinese authorities. The family of seven, which includes three women, have reportedly been hiding since 1999 in the large ethnic Korean community in Beijing. North Korea has suffered a major famine for the past 6 years due to drought and floods. It lost its major benefactor with the disintegration of the Soviet Union. For NPR News, I'm Michael Wengert in Seoul.
Activists protested today at the United Nations special session on AIDS. They are unhappy with the reluctance of many nations to commit billions of dollars to fight the disease. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
Members of activist groups from around the world held a press conference to demand more money for drugs to treat HIV. They also called for the forgiveness of loans to developing nations where AIDS is causing economic havoc. Sheila Kabuka is the director of Hope Africa.
How can we be expected to service debts when our people are dead or dying and sick? This is why we are demanding total debt cancellation.
The activists said they are outraged by some UN delegates' suggestion that money in a new global fund for AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria be spent primarily on prevention programs, not treatment. After the press conference, activists staged a noisy march through the UN's hallways. John Hamilton, NPR News, New York.
Congressional leaders today agreed to add more than $1.3 billion to a global campaign to fight AIDS. Secretary of State Colin Powell had pledged an increase yesterday at the UN. The full House and Senate must approve the plan. Stock markets closed mixed today. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials dropped nearly 32 points to 10,472 in active trading of almost 1.2 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 13 points to 2064. The S&P 500 fell 2 to 1216. This is NPR News. American troops were used in Macedonia for the first time yesterday to protect a convoy carrying ethnic Albanian rebels away from Macedonia's capital. A Pentagon spokesman said today that the event does not mark an expansion of American involvement. The familiar phrase, "you may already be a winner," has new meaning for people in 26 states. Publishers Clearinghouse has reached a $34 million settlement with the states over claims it used misleading and false language in its sweepstakes and subscription promotions. From Wisconsin Public Radio, Patty Murray reports.
The state said the company misled consumers by making them think they had won prizes or that they would win if they bought magazines. Publishers Clearinghouse was facing numerous lawsuits over its promotional campaigns. The only state to bring the company to trial was Wisconsin. Wisconsin is included in the settlement. Wisconsin Attorney General Jim Doyle.
They have agreed that they will no longer suggest to somebody that they might be a winner. They can no longer use documents that look like they are official documents in some way. They can no longer indicate that a purchase is necessary to enter the sweepstakes.
Last year, Publishers Clearing House reached an $18 million settlement with 24 other states. For NPR News, I'm Patty Murray in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld will request authority from Congress to reduce the Air Force B-1 bomber fleet by about 30 planes, or a third. Rumsfeld also wants to eliminate operation of B-1s from Air National Guard bases in Georgia and Kansas. That's according to senior defense officials. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After releasing 10 albums, my guest singer-songwriter and guitarist Steve Earle has published his first book. It's a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. Several of the stories are based on Earle's own life. Steve Earle moved to Nashville at the age of 19 and recorded his first album in 1986. In the 90s, he developed heroin and cocaine addictions. In 94, he was convicted for possession of narcotics. While serving several months in prison, followed by rehab, he gave up drugs. His 1995 comeback album, Train A-Comin', launched what Nick Hornby described in The New Yorker as one of the most creatively successful careers in contemporary American music. Hornby says, who else has recorded five good to great albums in 6 years? Earle has also established himself as a record producer. He started his own company, E Squared, and has produced albums by Ron Sexsmith and Lucinda Williams. Later he'll read from his book. Let's start with the title song from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. Steve Earle, welcome back to Fresh Air. When did you start writing fiction?
There's a story in here called Wheeler County, which I actually started in 89 or 90, thinking it was going to be a novel. But the truth of the matter was my drug habit was getting out of hand by that time, and I was having trouble even finishing records by that point. And I started pawning everything that wasn't tied down in my house, including the computer that the book was in, and I never backed it up, so that's gone forever. And when I got clean and got out of jail, I hadn't written a song in 4.5 years, and I wrote another record fairly easily, but I guess I was a little paranoid in there, and it seemed to me like I had all this time and energy on my hands because I didn't have to wake up and find $500 worth of dope, so there wasn't always a melody lying around, so I started writing fiction to write something every day as an exercise. I'm not even sure I ever really thought about publishing it at first. And the first thing I did was I reconstructed Wheeler County from memory and found out it was only a short story after all.
All right. Well, now when you write, you have your choice of fiction, nonfiction, or lyric.
Well, I also write poetry, and I'm writing a play. I write all the time, and I think writing in a lot of different, areas. I think the last record that I made, Transcendental Blues, I think the writing changed quite a bit, and I think it's a direct result of writing prose and writing poetry.
How do you think it changed?
I think it's more poetic. I think doing this, writing stories, is pretty close to what I do as a songwriter anyway, and as a songwriter, the long story songs, the songs that are basically narrative that rhymes, that's the easiest thing for me to do. It's always tougher for me to to do something that's a lot less words and a lot more emotionally driven than it is, you know, something that's a story with a beginning and a middle and an end.
I'd like to take a subject about which you've written a song, a short story, and a nonfiction piece, and the subject is witnessing an execution. Before we hear, we'll start with the song, but before we hear it, tell us a little bit about the person whose execution you witnessed.
His name was Jonathan Wayne Nobles, and he was one of several people that I corresponded with on death row around the country. And at one time, I think that was what the extent of my activism was I knew some guys on death row. They wrote me, I wrote them back. And I probably got a little too close, and John was in Texas, and he eventually got a date. And he wasn't innocent. He was guilty. For some reason, innocent guys don't write me. All my guys are guilty. But he asked me to witness his execution, and I was totally unprepared for that and didn't know how to say no, so I said yes. He just wanted one person there that didn't hate him.
What was he guilty of? What was he convicted of?
A really, really heinous double murder. John was probably, in his own estimation, he was an escalating sexually driven serial killer that happened to get caught the first time.
How did you end up corresponding with people on death row?
I wrote a song in 1990 called Billy Alston, and I've always been opposed to the death penalty. I grew up in Texas in a home that was opposed to the death penalty, and it was just what I was taught. That's probably not a good thing for us to be as a people and for our government to be involved in doing, for a lot of reasons. Then I wrote a song called Billy Alston that sort of deals with the subject, and then people from the movement started calling and writing me, and then inmates started writing me. And over the years, then my life got out of hand, and when I came back shortly after I started making records and being visible again, Tim Robbins called me, and he had just finished Dead Man Walking, and he asked me to write a song for that soundtrack, and that was LS Unit 1. And then all of the cast members of that soundtrack record did a benefit here in L.A. for murder victims' families for reconciliation. And meeting those people was a mind blower because they're murder victims' family members who are opposed to the death penalty and go out and work against the death penalty every day. Bud Welch, his daughter, was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing as a member. And they changed my life and the way that I approach my activism against the death penalty in this country.
So tell me something about what you saw or what you felt when you were witnessing Jonathan Wayne Noble's execution that ended up in the song that you wrote.
Well, I think the deal with John is he was suspicious of abolitionists, and his first priority, I think, was the victims' family members, including, in fact, he met with 2 weeks before he was killed. He met with the mother of one of his victims. John had changed. They didn't kill the same guy that they locked up. He still was very confused by what he did, but he converted to Catholicism, and he was a third order Dominican by the time he died, and he was a huge supporter of other people on death row. He stood up with Cliff Boggess, who was executed a year before him, who is another one of my correspondents, as his godfather at his baptism. And he started out being one of the most hated people by inmates and guards alike when he got there, and 12 years later when they killed him, he was loved by everyone at Ellis. In fact, I spent most of the day after he was executed delivering flowers and other gifts to people, a long list of people that worked for the prison system that John wanted to make sure that they knew that he appreciated, what they'd done for him.
Yeah, in your song, there's a line about who he wants, what his radio and his fan given to.
Yeah, John was, they've moved the guys in Texas now. Back then, they were on LS1 unit, which wasn't air conditioned, and it's Texas. And in fact, a year before John was executed, a diabetic death row inmate died in his cell from heat exhaustion. So fans are, you know, a real commodity, and you don't have a fan unless somebody in your family can buy it for you. So there were lots of guys that didn't have fans, and so he, John left a fan. He left left a radio. He left his dictionary. I've got. I spent 2 days planning for the funeral of a living, you know, helping a living, breathing man plan his own funeral and the distribution of what goods he had.
Anything else you want to say about the song before we hear it?
It was part of a process that I'm probably still going through of processing having. It's not a political song. My other death penalty songs are. They deal with my opposition to the death penalty as an idea. This is simply me processing the fact that I witnessed a horrific act.
Okay, this is Steve Earle, his song Over Yonder, Jonathan's song.
I suppose I got it coming. I can't ever pay enough. All my ripping and running, I hurt everyone I loved. The world to turn around without me, the sun will come up in the east, shining down. My going brings some peace. Well, I am going over yonder where no ghosts will find me. There's another place beyond here where I'll be free. That's what I believe.
And that's Over Yonder, Jonathan's song from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. Well, you talked about how in writing the song you felt you were still processing, having witnessed the execution. When did you write your short story in your new book that's about witnessing an execution?
I went to Galway in Ireland right after John was executed on October 7th. Not quite 3 years ago, and I left the country around the 15th or so, you know, within a week after John was executed, and I went to Ireland for several months, and part of it was, you know, to just sort of get away for a while, because I'd been working pretty hard, and then I witnessed an execution, and I needed the rest, and also to work on this book. By that time, I had a publisher and had an editor, and I was trying to write enough stories for a collection so I could publish this someday. And I wrote two stories. I wrote Over Yonder, and finished a couple of stories I was working on. And I sort of laid out this story, The Witness, which is fiction. It's actually got a whole another sort of plot going on in it, but it definitely draws very heavily from what I saw that day.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Steve Earle. He has a new collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Steve Earle, and he's a singer, songwriter, and guitarist with many CDs. He also now has his first book of short stories. It's called Doghouse Roses. Before I ask you to read an excerpt of your short story, The Witness, about witnessing an execution, I want to ask you what you were most unprepared for when you witnessed the execution of Jonathan Wayne Nobles.
My own empathy for the people that had to participate in that execution. John was really incredibly well prepared, and it was hard to watch. He was genuinely remorseful, and he was just trying to die the best that he could. But the other people, I don't know where it came from. I didn't see anything from them that would normally evoke empathy, but it just dawned on me what I was looking at was people protecting a relatively low-paying job with halfway decent benefits. It's the only industry in Huntsville, Texas, and is the prison system. And this damages everybody that touches it. My objection to the death penalty is not about what it does to the guys on death row as much as it is what it does to all of us. I object to the damage it does to my spirit if I kill somebody, and if my government kills somebody, then I'm killing somebody.
Well, let me ask you to read an excerpt of The Witness, and this story is told from the point of view of a corporate attorney whose wife was murdered, and the man convicted of murdering his wife is about to be executed. The corporate attorney is there to witness the execution. And at this moment is in the story, the man being executed has just picked up his head and stared at the observers. You want to pick it up from there?
Yeah. He mercifully turned away. Staring straight up at the ceiling, he took a long, ragged breath, closed his eyes, and began saying a Hail Mary in Spanish. Gordon knows that Chaplain Meeks was resting his right hand on Camacho's leg just below the knee. For some reason that he couldn't explain, the contact offended him. Now more than ever, Gordon wanted the whole horrible business over with. Finish. What Gordon didn't know was that the Hail Mary was the signal that Camacho had agreed to so that Warden Larkin knew he was ready, and Gordon had missed the warden's subtle hand signal to the unseen executioner behind the one-way glass. Therefore, he had no way of knowing that the poison had already made its way down the plastic tubing and was racing through Andres Camacho's body. Ahora y en la hora de la muerte nuestra. Andy's prayer was interrupted by a sound from his own lips, a low-pitched bark, a startling incongruous sound like a small child with whooping cough, as the air was suddenly forced from his lungs and his head pitched forward until his chin lodged on his chest. It was as if an invisible anvil had been dropped on his chest from a great height. It was much more violent than Gordon had ever imagined it would be. He had somehow convinced himself that this would be different somehow. On paper, it was efficient and clinical. Instead, there was the unmistakable sense that he was witnessing a soul being brutally and unnaturally ripped from a human body.
Now, you know that kind of barking that you're describing, that the executed man goes through at the moment of death? Is that something that happened in the execution you witnessed?
Yeah, and it varies. I mean, some people, I know people that have witnessed executions. I was fortunate enough to have a lady named Karen Sebung, who had witnessed an execution before me, who I was friendly with in Houston. That prepared me to some extent for what I was going to see, and it's different. I mean, some people yawn, and some people there's a gasp, but basically it's a massive dose of pentobarbital, and which that we're told that that's to put them to sleep before the second chemical collapses their lungs. And the truth of the matter is a massive overdose of pentobarbital collapses your lungs. The second one makes sure that they don't inflate themselves, because people have different tolerances to drugs. What I saw and John's execution was, it was so, John was singing when he was executed. His signal was, he sang Silent Night. And when he got to the line, Mother and Child, the sound was so loud, it was like, huh! And then he didn't make another sound, and he didn't move. But as he expelled that air, his head pitched forward violently enough that his heavy plastic prison glasses fell off of his face, bounced off of his chest, and landed on the floor.
You didn't take notes at the execution, did you?
No, I couldn't have if I'd wanted to. I mean, the press can do that, but I couldn't have done that.
You mean you weren't allowed to?
No, I wasn't allowed. You're not. Texas is one of the most restrictive death row. You don't. There are no contact visits on death row. You can't take any writing instruments into death row, or into the walls, which is where the executions actually take place.
Why did you want to write a story about this?
Well, I wanted to do it because it's how I process things. I've been writing all my life, I had John's permission explicitly, which I didn't ask for. Last time I saw John, where I could talk to him, was at 12:30, right before he was taken over to the walls, the day of his execution. Texas executes people at 6 in the evening. So one of the last things he said to me was, he says, "You have my permission to use anything that you saw here against the death penalty or, you know, for artistic reasons." And that wasn't something that I asked him for. And I probably, if he hadn't said that, I probably would have written it down, but I probably wouldn't have published anything.
One of the observations that you make in your short story about the execution is that, you know, a lot of convicts have been junkies, and for a former junkie who's getting executed, it's harder to find veins for the lethal injection IV. How'd you learn about that?
Well, I mean, it's not. I've been doing work against the death penalty for a long time. I've watched states change over from, we keep track of, Florida held Ellen in the electric chair longer than anybody, but a lot of states have recently switched over to lethal injection. And in the early days of lethal injection, there have been botched executions by that method as well. And one of the problems that they run into is that there's 80% of the people we have behind bars in this country for any reason are there for drug-related charges. And a lot of those people are IV drug addicts. That's the main reason that AIDS is so prevalent in our prison system. I've been through having to have medical procedures myself and had them have trouble finding a vein. Sometimes, I've been to the dentist a few times when I wanted to, I had to have a lot of dental work, done right after I got clean. And a couple of times I've wanted to just take needles away from people because I felt like I could do a better job than they could. But it's a common problem, and these are stories that unfortunately pass around among people that have witnessed executions and just people around the movement in general.
Steve Earle will be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, a work of fiction by David Schickler. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Remember last election? Everybody was in action, trying to find themselves the president.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on three blues musicians, Blind Blake, Blind Lemon Jefferson, and Blind Boy Fuller. Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel Bel Canto, and we continue our conversation with Steve Earle.
My brother was a voter, also a great promoter, going around giving advice. They go down to the poll and vote. Did our voting once, we voted twice. He's in their jailhouse now. He's in their jailhouse now. We got him downtown in jail. No one to go his bail. He's in their jailhouse now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer, songwriter, guitarist, and record producer Steve Earle. He's just published his first book, a collection of short stories called Doghouse Roses. In 1994, Earle was arrested for possession of narcotics. He spent several months in prison and then went into rehab. He launched a successful comeback in 1995, which has included 5 albums, 3 Grammy nominations, and founding his own record label, E Squared. The last time we spoke, it was pretty shortly in your comeback after you gave up dope. How easy or hard has it been to stay clean? I mean, your career has really been doing well. Your records, as far as I can tell, have been doing well. And
Right. You've
been producing records by other people. I mean, it seems like your comeback has been pretty successful. But how hard has it been to keep healthy?
It hasn't been easy, but it's been simple. I know what to do. I tried everything else. And I still do exactly the same things that I was doing when we last spoke. I'm maybe even more dedicated to that way of life now. It is my way of life. It's my spiritual system. And I really didn't have one before. So I've watched people with more time than I have relapse, and that's happened a couple of times recently. Not quite 7 years. I'll have 7 years in September if I keep doing the right stuff. And I've seen a few people with 12 and 14 years clean relapse recently, and that's terrifying. But it doesn't have to happen. I know that, too. I've seen other people, relapse is not necessarily a part of recovery. And if I keep doing the right things, I really do believe that it'll continue to work for me.
Now that you've been writing a lot, how has writing affected what you're reading? Are you reading more than ever?
Well, I read a lot. I've got an eighth grade education, so I'm sorry I had to educate myself. And I've always read a lot. I read a lot more nonfiction than I do fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, and I read a lot of poetry, and I read some fiction. I read all the time, but I go through periods of, I'll discover a writer. And I have a tendency to discover a writer and then read absolutely everything they've written in a relatively short period of time. I was that way. I discovered Graham Greene in my late 20s and read absolutely everything. And I read and reread Mark Twain to this day. I'm God knows how many times I've read Huckleberry Finn, and I completely and totally agree with Ernest Hemingway when he said that don't bother to go write the great American novel because it's already been written and it's called Huckleberry Finn. Lately I've been reading Michael Ondaatje probably wrote my favorite book. It's called Coming Through Slaughter, and it's his first novel, but it was published in 79, somewhere in there. He's a great poet, and of course he's known more for novels that he's written since then. But Coming Through Slaughter is like a form of literature that, as far as I know, didn't exist before then. It is poetry, and it is prose, and it is history. It deals with a person who really lived, Buddy Bolden, who was a cornet player in New Orleans at the turn of the century, who somewhat of an enigma just because no one knows what he sounded like because he never made records. His career existed before electronic recording, but everyone that came out of New Orleans heard him play. Louis Armstrong knew what Buddy Bolden sounded like, so in a way we've all heard Buddy Bolden and his influence.
Steve Earle is my guest, and he's a singer, songwriter, guitarist with several CDs, and now he has a new book of short stories, which is called Doghouse Roses. You've been producing records by other people, including Lucinda Williams and Ron Sexsmith. Why have you gotten so involved in producing other people's music?
I think it's about teaching. I also teach a course at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and I do that for the same reason that I produce records. Teaching is really important. If you teach and you do it right, then you learn so much. And I steal shamelessly from younger bands that I produce, and sometimes it's contemporaries. I mean, we're working with Lucinda. That's someone I've known since I was 17 years old, and we sort of came up together and in the same circles in Texas. And but my favorite thing is producing and baby bands that have never made a record before. You know, Ron is a great writer. Ron's like I've known him for a long time. And he was kind of a protege at one point years ago, but he's grown up into this. You know, he's as good as most people are lyrically, and he has no peer in pop music melodically nowadays. I don't think anyone else writes melodies like that. But the thing that's really fun is producing records on bands like Six String Drag and finding bands like Marat and you know, young bands that have never made a record before. That's fun. That's when you know, and if you're doing it right, you know, you learn a huge amount, and hopefully you can make it easier for people to concentrate on what's important. You know, when they're you know, when they're in the studio, when they're in an uncomfortable environment, and help them learn their way around that environment and how to make records for the rest of their lives.
Influences that you've recently gotten deeper into include bluegrass and the Beatles. And there's a lot of harmony in both of those, although the harmonies are different.
Yeah.
Have you gotten more involved in singing harmony?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've gotten, I write, the main thing that's changed in my writing is I write more chick songs.
More chick songs? What does that
yeah,
mean?
it means I write a lot more pretty songs, and which serves several purposes. I've become more interested in melody. It also prevents my audience from getting exponentially hairier and uglier as time goes on, because I have to look at them, too.
Wait, so let's get back to harmony.
Harmony is like something that's been a weak suit for me. And I was always a really bad harmony singer. But from singing with people that were good harmony singers over the last few years, I've gotten better at it. And so I don't automatically break out when someone, you know, people will very casually ask you to come sing harmony on their record and as a guest. And that used to cause me a lot of consternation. And I feel a lot more confident when I'm asked to do that, because I think I understand how harmony works a little bit better.
The title story in your new book, Doghouse Roses, is about somebody who's kind of leaving town. It starts off with somebody who's leaving town after
right.
a relationship has fallen apart. And, you know, we've been talking a little bit about how you've been writing about similar subjects in your songs and in your stories. The idea of being on the road or hitting the road is well, it's one of the oldest subjects in certainly in country music and in rock music and the blues. And even on your new CD, on your most recent CD, Transcendental Blues, there's two songs about the road. And one of them is about the person threatening to hit the road and burn the house down.
Right.
And in the other, the person has been on the road and they're thinking giving up the road and hanging up their highway shoes.
Right.
And they're really good songs that are opposite sides
of
the same coin. I'm wondering if that's been a theme in your life, the desire to hit the road and the desire to get off the road.
Sure it has, but, you know, and I'm dealing with it right now. I'm getting towards the end of the tour. I'm in the best relationship I've ever been in my life. I like to be home a lot better, you know, a lot more than I used to. And Sarah is sort of like, well, you know, like almost everybody else I've ever been with, it's like, well, I knew you toured, but I didn't know you toured. And this tour's gone on longer than I intended it to, and so I'm ready for it to be over with. At the same time, I have to admit that I do, when I'm home for any, you know, for an extended period of time, I start wondering what it would be like to get back on a bus. And I like to roll after the show and spend the night on the bus and wake up in another town. And I've been doing it for most of my life. But things are slowing down a little bit. And actually, Another Town was written, the one about burning the house down, was written, I was using tools that I'd been using in writing songs about leaving towns all my life and trying to lend somebody else a voice, because that song was written for Sarah to sort of lend her a voice. And when we first met and she was in a situation where I think she needed to make a move, and I was just sort of being a cheerleader there, whereas Steve's Last Ramble is a little bit more just me.
Well, I thought maybe we'd play the beginning of those back-to-back.
Okay.
And compare these two instincts. Steve Earle, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your music and your stories.
Thank you.
One of these days in the miles, and I'm thinking about burning it then. And I'll be long gone when the fire burns out. Just rambling around and hanging up my highway shoes. Then when I walk and make a hollow sound, and it carry me away from you. Every night I lay my body down, and my empty arms just leave me go. So I'm thinking rambling round and find my way back home to you.
Two songs from Steve Earle's latest CD, Transcendental Blues. His new collection of short stories is called Doghouse Roses. Coming up, Ed Ward on three blues musicians, Blind Blake, Blind Boy Fuller, and Blind Lemon Jefferson. This is Fresh Air. In today's celebrity culture, we expect to learn every little detail of stars' lives. But as rock historian Ed Ward shows us, by contrasting three blind bluesmen, some famous musicians of the past have been complete enigmas, while less famous ones were sometimes better documented.
Perhaps no single blues song has had such an odyssey as Blind Lemon Jefferson's Matchbox Blues. It was a huge hit when it was first released in 1927, copied by dozens of other blues singers at the time, and from them went into the repertoire of Carl Perkins, the rockabilly singer and guitarist who learned his music from the black sharecroppers his family lived and worked with. From there, it went to the Beatles, who recorded it early in their career. But of Lemon Jefferson, we know next to nothing. We know he was from the countryside outside of Dallas, that he got a reputation as a great guitar player in its black honky-tonks, and that he recorded for Paramount Records, becoming its first blues star and selling countless records for them. We don't know for sure how old he was when he died in December 1929, or how he died, despite a legend that he froze to death in the snow in Chicago.
What it was, kind baby, I asked of you. What is one kind favor I ask of you? Lord, it's one kind favor I ask of you. Please ask my greatest kept.
His song, See That My Grave's Kept Clean, became a huge hit, again getting recorded in various versions over the years and remaining one of the most mystical of all blues recordings. But even his name, Lemon, remains a mystery. He's not the only one. Perhaps the greatest guitar virtuoso to record in the 20s was Blind Blake, who also recorded for Paramount starting in 1926. He was the only one of Paramount's artists who outsold Lemon Jefferson, no doubt because his guitar style spanned the era of ragtime and blues, and thus appealed to a wider audience. He left behind dozens of records and continued recording until Paramount went out of business in 1932. His songs, too, have survived to the present day.
A gangster shot his pal today as they carried him away. He said, diddy war, diddy. He said, diddy war, diddy. I just find out what diddy war, diddy means. Police walk right up to him. Look who's here, old two-gun Jim. Mr. Diddy war, diddy. Mr. Diddy war, diddy. I just find out what diddy war, diddy means.
Incredibly, only two things are known about Blind Blake. First, that his name was Arthur. Second, that he was blind. Paramount claimed he was from Florida, but nobody knows for sure. When was he born? When did he die? We don't know. We're far more likely to find out definitively what Diddy Wah Diddy means. Part of the problem of dealing with these men is that they recorded for absolutely the worst record company of its time. Paramount was a subsidiary of a furniture company which made phonographs and only made records to give customers something to play on them. They recorded bluesmen, loads of them, because it didn't cost much, and they used the cheapest possible shellac so that the few Paramount records which survive are in terrible shape. They didn't care a bit who their artists were or, unless they sold as well as Jefferson and Blake, if they ever came back. But this wasn't the case with other record companies.
Town, hat in my hand, looking for a woman, ain't got no man. This way be looking for a needle in the sand. Looking for a woman, ain't got no man. Oh, Ray, 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 said do that, Ray. Oh, Ray, oh, Ray, Ray, said do that, Ray.
We know that Blind Boy Fuller was born on July 10, 1907, and that his real name was Fulton Allen. In 1925, he married a 14-year-old girl named Cora May, and it was at this point that his eyes started to fail him. He and his wife moved to Durham, North Carolina, and he began playing guitar. He took lessons from the Reverend Gary Davis, the reigning guitar champion of the area, and before long, a local record store owner brought him to the attention of the American Recording Company.
I've forsaken my sister, forsaken my brother, I've forsaken my daddy and my dead old mother. I had to do that to change that woman's name. But now she's fixing to leave me, ain't that a crying shame?
His first record, Ain't It a Cryin' Shame, became a hit, and soon he was making regular visits to New York to record, often with Gary Davis and another guitarist named Bull City Red, whose real name was George Washington. Fuller's recordings pretty much define what is now called Piedmont blues and made it possible for a new generation of bluesmen, including Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, to get heard. Fuller took sick in 1940 and was in and out of the hospital until he decided to die at home and let Cora May nurse him. He died on February 13, 1941. There's an interesting coda here, too. Not far from Fuller, there lived a tailor whose son was very interested in music. He obviously had a deep understanding of the blues, but he was only 15 when Fuller died. We'll never know. Did John Coltrane ever hear Blind Boy Fuller?
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Here's more from Blind Boy Fuller.
I woke up this morning about 4:30. Somebody knocking on my back door, saying, that's my rattlesnake and daddy. That's my rattlesnake and daddy. That's my rattlesnake and daddy. Wants to rattle all the time. Yes, he rattled this morning about 3:30. 4:30, he want to rattle some more. Cause that's my rattlesnake and daddy. That's my rattlesnake and daddy. That's my rattlesnake and daddy, who wants to rattle all the time. I got a range in my kitchen, big, bad, nice and brown. Get my rattlesnake daddy, turn me down, but upside down. Cause I'm a rattlesnake and daddy. Cause I'm a rattlesnake and daddy. I'm a rattlesnake and daddy, who wants to rattle all the time. Rattle now, boy.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Ann Patchett's new novel, Bel Canto. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Ann Patchett, whose earlier books include The Patron Saint of Liars and The Magician's Assistant, knew next to nothing about opera before she began researching her new novel, Bel Canto. Writing Bel Canto turned Patchett into an opera buff, and reading it turned book critic Maureen Corrigan into a Patchett fan.
I've sat through exactly one opera in my life, Aida, which was put on in Central Park at night one summer when I was 18 or 19. I went with a girlfriend, and I dimly remember our motivations had nothing to do with culture and a lot to do with getting away from our parents, drinking some bad wine, and meeting boys. That's how clueless I was. I thought you could meet boys at an opera. About opera, I remain clueless, although I'm much more intrigued by its attractions after reading Ann Patchett's haunting novel, Bel Canto. For those familiar with operatic plots and techniques, the novel must offer a witty, insider reading experience. But even a bumpkin like me can thrill to the sheer flamboyance of Bel Canto's melodrama, its gracefully interwoven plot lines, its looming intimations of tragedy. The narrative premise of Bel Canto owes a lot to those Agatha Christie-type mysteries where a Baroque cast of strangers gathers together on an island or in a manor house, only to have their lives put in peril. In Patchett's novel, the remote locale is the vice president's mansion in an unnamed South American country. Wealthy businessmen and dignitaries from all around the world have been invited to a birthday celebration in honor of Mr. Hosokawa, the founder of a Japanese electronics company. The host country hopes that Mr. Hosokawa will be so softened up by gratitude that he'll be induced to build a factory there. The rest of the guests hope that they can hop aboard this gravy train. Of course, Mr. Hosokawa wouldn't fly halfway across the world just for some free champagne, so the hook has been lavishly baited. Since Mr. Hosokawa is an opera nut, the famous diva, Roxanne Kos, has been induced at an exorbitant price to come and sing six arias for the assembled guests. She's just concluded her party piece when the lights go out in the cavernous drawing room and an army of gun-toting terrorists leaps from the air conditioning vents. The terrorists had planned to take their country's president hostage, but he stayed home to watch his favorite soap opera. More irony. Mr. Hosokawa never considered investing in the host country. He accepted the invitation in bad faith, simply because he wanted to breathe the same air as his idol, Roxanne Kos. Except for Roxanne, all of the women and the workers are released. Everyone else is stuck for the duration, and slowly, Patchett's story takes on the sheen of a utopian fantasy, where people who initially came together out of grimy self-interest begin to forge deep emotional bonds as a result of proximity and of the uplifting influence of Roxanne's daily musical performances. An alternate world develops inside the mansion that no one struggles to leave. Here's how Patchett affectingly describes the be here now bliss of one of the terrorists, a country girl named Carmen. None of her family, left behind in the mountains, could have understood that there was a house made of bricks and sealed glass windows that was never too hot or too cold. In addition, there was food that came every day. Yes, the generals wanted something better for the people, but weren't they the people? Would it be the worst thing in the world if nothing happened at all, if they all stayed together in this generous house? Carmen prayed that God would look on them and see the beauty of their existence and leave them alone. Of course, every man, prisoner and captor alike, falls at least a little in love with the diminutive, dazzling Roxanne, described as a pocket Venus. Mr. Hosokawa's overworked personal translator, Jen Watanabe, translates the babble of all their multilingual tributes into English for Roxanne to demurely accept. In a Shakespearean turn, she and Mr. Hosokawa become lovers, while Jen and Carmen, who masquerades as a boy for much of the novel, find that passion needs no translation. It's all hokey as heck and so very affecting. I imagine that Patchett's lithe writing style and her tone, by turns wry and teasing and mournful, does for this creaky plot what a great singer's voice does for a moth-eaten libretto. Bel Canto soars above its narrative cliches and revels in them.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bel Canto by Ann Patchett. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Naomi Person, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vintage Books, a division of Random House, and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, actor John Lithgow. His series Third Rock from the Sun just completed its run on NBC. He's now one of the stars of the animated film Shrek. He's written a new children's book and is giving children's concerts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.